every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, tell this to everybody wherever they are. Watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard. My guest today is Premi Mohammed. Her recent short story collection is called No One Will Come Back for Us, and her forthcoming novella is The Butcher of the Forest. Well, hello. Welcome to Retro Rockets. Can you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Absolutely love to. And thank you so much for inviting me. Yeah, my name is Premi Mohammed. I'm a scientist and an author based in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. I don't know who's listening, so let's get as geographically clear as we can. I have a number of books out, three novels, a handful of novellas. In 2023, my debut short story collection, No One Will Come Back for Us, came out from Undertow Publications. Very excited about that. And I will be having four books coming out next year, it looks like, and quite a few short stories in sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and mashups of all of the above.
Very exciting. Where can we find you online? Do you have a website or any other places where you're active online?
Yeah, I'm technically still on Twitter/X at Premisaurus. It's mostly updates at the moment. I'm very active on Blue Sky under my website because they let you do that. So my website is just premimohammed.com.
Excellent. So you have like a bazillion books coming out next year. And the one, yeah, and the one I'm most excited about is called The Butcher of the Forest. And there is not a ton of information out there about this, but what I heard through the grapevine is that it is a dark fantasy, and it has riddles, and it has monsters, and it has time limits, which sounds terrifying. And I also read somewhere that the idea came from a dream that you had. So I guess if you can talk about it without giving too many spoilers, what can you tell us about The Butcher of the Forest?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm very excited about that one. That is my first novella out with Tor.com. It's being edited by Jonathan Stran. And yeah, as it mentioned in the Tor.com announcement, it did come to me in a dream. And I know it's really ridiculous for writers to say that something came to them in a dream. I think we get mocked for it because dreams have no logic and they make no sense. And that probably would have been the case with this dream. But just as I was waking up, all I remembered was a single glance at where I was in the dream, which was this kind of dark place with firelight. So I knew there was a fire and kind of a back wall made out of stone with a bunch of skulls on it that looked like trophies, that were mounted like trophies. And, you know, I woke up feeling kind of fearful, like, oh my God, where am I? And somebody had said in my ear just before I woke up, and I didn't know who, do dreams have narrators? I don't know. Someone said, but can the children be held responsible for the sins of the father? And I woke up and I scribbled it down. And later in the day, I found myself thinking, you know, maybe that would make kind of a cool little flash story. Like, maybe this is the end.
Like the end of the story.
Yeah, the end of the story. Maybe this is a trial or something like that. Maybe somebody's being found guilty, or maybe someone's not being found guilty. And maybe they're trying to dissociate the children from the father. But I couldn't stop thinking about the setting too. And that's really where the story started. So I wrote that scene where a character is thinking, can the children be held responsible for the sins of the father? And what should I do about it? And then from there, I wrote backward and then I wrote forward. And I ended up finishing the whole thing in just kind of one very excited spurt of about 3 weekends.
That's fast.
And yeah. And it was funny because I had, the reason I think it got acquired was because I had tweeted about it, just the idea, right at the start of that first writing session. And Jonathan wrote back to be like, that sounds cool. I would read that. I'm like, no, you wouldn't. So I finished it and I sent it to my agent, who was like, what's this? Where did this come from? I didn't know you were writing this. I thought I was kind of on top of everything you were doing. I'm like, I don't know where it came from. This guy at tor.com says he wants to read it, so we can let him read it. And then if he doesn't want it, we can, you know,
we'll send it to somebody else. Right, right.
Yeah. But it ended up finding a home. And I think I found a really good home. And Jonathan's edits really kind of reflected that. He kept a very light touch on the story and just let it be dark and weird and have that asymmetrical structure. And yeah, I'm excited for people to read it. I hope they enjoy it.
You had me at asymmetrical. And like also the tour press release, I saw the thing about, oh, there's riddles. Oh, there's monsters. And then you said asymmetrical and I'm all in. It's funny about, like you got the idea out of a dream. And what I'm about to talk about is, you know, very much an internet rumor. I have no idea if it's true, but I love it. It's that, I don't know if you read the Area X novels from Jeff Vandermeer, but there's been this rumor that the wording in the tunnel came to him in a dream, and he woke up and just like scribbled all this stream of consciousness down that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, and it's in those books. So
I would believe it.
So yeah. I think it's great when people wake up. When people wake up from dreams and it's like, what in the heck was that? And they write it down and these wonderful stories come out of it. So
yeah, well, this has happened to me several times, and it's never a matter of writing down the dream and making a story out of the dream. It's always an image. Like I recently had one. This isn't related to anything, but you said tangents were okay. This isn't related to anything, but I had this very, very clear dream, super ultra 4K clear, of I knew it was a modern art exhibit. You know how you just know things in dreams? I knew it was a modern art exhibit. There were a bunch of people dressed in gray coveralls, and they were on various like steps and scaffolding, and they were painting red marks on a wall. And I knew that the red marks represented people who had died from some specific disease in the dream. And it wasn't AIDS and it wasn't COVID. It was something, but it was over. And now there was this modern art exhibit of people who were painting the marks on the wall. And then afterwards, another group of people in the same coveralls would come and paint over the marks. So they disappeared. And I thought,
I would read that story.
Yeah, that's got to be a flash of some kind. I can tell that from the point of view of one of the painters. Trying to figure out what the artist meant, because maybe the artist died of this disease.
And and just like people coming later and painting over it, like,
and
okay,
erasing the marks.
You have to write this because I need to know the reason why they're painting over it.
Yeah. I wish the dream had told me, but that's what makes writing fun, is we get to figure it out.
I love that. I had one of those like very detailed 4K, very, very, very detailed dreams. And it was basically me being an idiot and my best friend getting absolutely sick of my shenanigans. And then at the end of the dream, like, she whips out this American Express of like, we're not doing this anymore, Andrea. We're leaving this idiotic thing that you have gotten us lost in. And I should probably text her and let her know that in my dream, she was very sick of me getting us lost in wherever we were. But it was very detailed and very funny.
Whenever my friends appear in my dreams, I text them immediately in the morning. Like, I have no filter. They should be used to this by now.
Oh, she's absolutely used to me having no filter and just sending. I mean, we've been friends since high school, so she's used to me sending her absurd things. So, but I guess we should kind of come back to like talking about like science fiction and short stories. I want to talk about the new novella just a tiny bit more before we get on, because I have like a bazillion questions for you, because I just think you're very, very cool. You got the part of the idea for The Butcher of the Forest from this dream that you had, and then, you know, of course, this story was born out of it. While you were writing it over those 3 weekends, like, what kind of things were you thinking about? Like, did your original idea kind of evolve into something a little bit different? Or, like, what was that process like?
Yeah, this was a weird one. It kind of went the way it often goes, which is, especially for novellas, what comes first generally is the premise, kind of the what if. So in this case, it was, what if the father is guilty and the children are innocent? Which is the way it should be. You know, your crimes and your sins, if we're using that word, your transgressions aren't hereditary.
And your children have no idea that you have done any of these things.
Yeah, because they're children. So that's where it kind of came from. And then from there, what often happens is I ask myself, what would be a way to illustrate this premise in a way that entertains me to write? So in this case, I thought of that wall with the skulls and the fire and how kind of primitive and barbaric and Conan the Barbarian it felt. And so I extrapolated all the world building from that. This is a throne room. There's a tyrant, and he is the person who has killed the people whose skulls now hang on this wall because he likes to take trophies. This is how we illustrate that he's not a nice guy. We have to find different ways of illustrating that his children are unrelated to this. And then I have to find a way of separating them. And then I have to find a way to illustrate that the children need rescuing and they can't be rescued by him. So that's kind of where the story evolved from. So Varys Thorne in the story is this kind of, you know, I guess middle-aged woman. She's probably about my age, who has done the impossible once and rescued a child from this very dangerous magical forest. So now she's dragged in front of the tyrant and told, you know, get his children back or else your village is toast.
And she's like,
that's how tyrants work. And she's like, well, I can't really say no. Because that's how fairy tales go, is you can't say no. You can't exit the structure of the story. And the reason I refer to it as asymmetrical is when we look at the standard plot structure, like Freytag's triangle, it's slanted so far towards the climax. So the climax is the big yes-no. Is the protagonist going to achieve the goal that they started off with or not? Yes or no? So like that should, in theory, be coming fairly late in the book, sort of like three quarters of the way through. Otherwise, you're just dragging to the ending. Mm-hmm. But this one, because of the kind of fairy tale structure, that point comes in the middle. So the question is, can Varys rescue the children or not? So that yes or no comes in the middle. And then they have to get out of the forest if she does rescue them.
And it's like you mentioned that she's already done this once. Mm-hmm. So like anytime, like in reality, anytime somebody mm-hmm. does something once, everyone yeah. else is like, oh, well, you must be very good at this. It can't possibly be that difficult. And I'm assuming that what she has accomplished the one time was actually quite difficult. And now she has to try to do it again.
Yeah, under threat. And yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah, and I thought that was kind of an interesting part of her backstory specifically. We don't understand much about the backstory of the tyrant. He's not the one I'm interested in. It's Varys, really, that I'm interested mm-hmm. in, is... where is her ability to go into the forest and come back out coming from? Where was her desire to do that last time going in and coming out coming from? Because in this world, in the world building, what we understand is that once somebody does go past that point in this forest, back home, all they do is they throw a funeral. Like they understand nobody comes out because no one ever has.
But she did it that one time.
Did it the one time. After the funeral.
Oh.
So that was hard. But she came back out with the child alive once. And it's never happened again. And it had never happened before. So I thought that was kind of an interesting mystery itself in the story. Like a question that is raised and just hangs above everybody's heads. Even the kids.
Oh, that had to be be just so fascinating. Such an interesting idea to play with. That, you know, she obviously had some motivation the first time that she did it, and I feel like in my mind there's some kind of assumption that well she did it the one time, so she must do it the next time. And there's no like the tyrant and everybody else isn't giving any thought to what was her motivation the first time and what is her motivation this time, other than the fact that like she doesn't want to die.
Yeah.
But like why people do things in stories is really fascinating for me.
Yeah. Well, it felt fascinating in this case too, because as you mentioned, the tyrant doesn't know why she went in there. He certainly doesn't care. And to him, nothing could be less important. He just...
There's a fluffy cat there.
Yeah. He was very good for the previous thing I did today. I don't know what he's doing here. Yeah, which is specifically in the story too, like in the novella, the tyrant is a conqueror. He has come in here. This is what he does, is he takes over various lands. And what he's done is he's taken over this village and the valley and the forest around it. He's killed thousands, maybe by this point, tens of thousands of people. We don't even know who he's killed personally, except for the people up on the wall. He's a monster. He's destroyed her people. He's ruined her life. She would say no if she could. So it's also kind of a colonization narrative, is that you are being coerced to do this by the colonizer. What is going to come out of this except bad, you know? But at the same time, the children weren't responsible for this.
Oh, that's so complicated.
That as well. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
I guess maybe too complicated for kind of the fairy tale or fable that I meant for it to feel like. But as you say, you know, there's riddles also. There's tests. There's certainly monsters. This is not a nice forest. So that was all really fun to come up with as well.
But I really love that, you know, like in the idea of a fairy tale, you know, there's these rules that we still abide by of, you know, the person can't say no. And there's going to be monsters in the forest. And I don't know, I love some of those rules because it's like, okay, we're kind of a teensy weensy bit trapped in this specific rule, but look at all these really cool, creative, original things that we can do with it. And I don't know, I love stories like that.
Yeah, I like working with those fairy tale rules.
Mm-hmm.
And I like setting them up at the start. You know, you only have a day to do this. You can't do this once you're in the forest. You can't do that. You can't shed the blood of anything in the forest. So Varys doesn't even take a weapon. Just in case there's a risk of her doing that. She doesn't even take a knife, that kind of thing. So,
and it's like,
I made up some rules.
and it's, and like, that's the beauty of stories like that, is they exist within these rules. And like, just, I'm just like thinking about what's going through her head where, you know, she's doing this task for this horrible, horrible human. And she can't say no to him. And she's rescuing these innocent children. But by rescuing these innocent children, this allows this man's legacy to continue. And it's like, how do you live with that afterwards?
How do you reconcile that?
Yeah.
And it's mentioned right away, too. You know, the older child is literally the heir. Which is why the tyrant is so emphatic that this rescue must take place, that there is no option of saying no.
And she's like,
why am I rescuing the heir to the tyrant?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Why am I perpetuating this horrible colonization?
Yeah. And at the same time, though, it is two little kids lost in a very dangerous forest. Like, I don't know what I would do. I mean, I do know what I would do because my life and my family and my village would be under threat. But I don't know what I'd be thinking. Like, Varys is made out of very tough stuff.
And it's like, you see these little kids and nobody wants harm to come to a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old, you know? I was at a baby naming this morning and like everybody in this room was like, we will never allow harm to come to this 3-week-old baby. I happened to look at some photos of my niece and she's like 12 years old. And it's like, I would do anything to keep this. Keep this obnoxious preteen safe. She's at this wonderful age where she's a wonderfully obnoxious preteen.
Yeah, 12 is the perfect age.
It really
my friend's 11-year-old is like that already. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Retro Rockets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our guest today is Premi Mohammed. You can hear this and other episodes at retrorocketspodcast.podbean.com. You can also listen to Retro Rockets on Spotify and Amazon Music. Like this episode or have questions? Let's chat on Blue Sky. I'm at retrorockets.bsky.social. So while we're recording this episode, it is the first week of November, and you have been just insanely busy. Every time I'm looking at your, you know, looking at your posts on X or on Blue Sky, it's, you know, oh, I'm doing this, oh, I'm doing that, oh, I'm doing this library program, I'm doing this workshop. It's like every single week in October and every single week in November. You were a guest at CanCon, you did a whole bunch of bookstore events, you've done a whole bunch of workshops. So like two-part question. First part, how in the world do you have the energy for all of these things? Second part, tell me about some really cool stuff that's happened over the last couple of weeks that you got to do.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, the first question is, it's tough. I think the only way that it's working, because I'm still kind of suffering. I'm not going to say long COVID because I'm in denial. I'm still kind of suffering some post-viral effects from catching COVID for the first time last year in October. It completely messed me up. I did not start even remotely feeling better until like May or June this year.
Oh, wow. Like,
I still feel really rough. I start sunsetting most days at like 6 or 7 o'clock. Like I take naps. The only way it's working is that I did leave my full-time job in March, partly for health and medical reasons, partly because I was really, really burning out. And partly because I thought if I'm going to give up something in my life, may as well be the thing I hate now. So I used to love my job. That changed. And I put up with it for probably too long, maybe a year and a half before giving up. And I, at the time, was still planning to job hunt and find another real job. But it kind of hasn't happened. And I've just been coasting, doing things like the workshops and the panels and teaching to make ends meet. So that's kind of the reason that there's so much on my schedule is, if you're a freelancer, you're familiar with the constant dog paddle of I will drag my exhausted, horrible carcass anywhere for $200 if that's what you guys are offering. So it does take quite a few of those gigs every month to pay the bills, which is exhausting. You end up working like 100 hours in a week to get paid for like 12. But it's a living.
And you're talking about things that you enjoy. I too made a huge career change 6 or 8 months ago where it was, if there's one thing in my life that I want to get rid of, it is, you know, this day job that's making me so miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I did.
High five, getting rid of day job solidarity.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's just got to be done. I should have recognized the symptoms of burnout earlier, I think, because the last time I did it, it was about 2007, and it was really, really bad. It was actually much worse than this, I think. But I put up with this much longer. But yeah, I mean, it is all stuff that I like to do and I'm excited to do. I love to teach. I don't mind going to the conferences and panels and stuff, although, of course, it's tricky during COVID. People aren't masking. Everything I go to, I'm like, is this going to be a super spreader event? Am I going to catch the plague again? I got lucky these last couple of trips doing it. But CanCon was great. We had a really good event at Perfect Books in Ottawa. And what was so amazing about that was not just the crowd, which was all the chairs filled up, then it was standing room only, and then people kept coming in.
Where'd you put them all?
And the whole bookstore was full of people. And Amal El-Mortar was the moderator, so kind of guiding our conversation about The Book of Witches, which just came out. Which is a wonderful anthology, just yay thick, just this hardback anthology of all witch stories. And, Fonda Lee was there. And then there was me and Millie Ho, who is a poet. And we talked about our works and people asked lots of questions. And we signed a blorbillion books and we stayed like an hour or something afterwards, just chatting to people that wanted to talk about writing and books. And it was so nice. It was just... It was so booky. It was just booky thing.
It's just
happened to me for ages, and everyone was so wonderful and friendly. It was nice.
It's so nice to be surrounded by people who love the same things that you love.
Yes, that was exactly it.
Yeah.
And then this past weekend, for which I assume my cat will eventually forgive me. I was at Get Lit in Calgary, which was put on by the Alexandra Writers Center Society. So they do this, I think it's not every month, but every other month, and then they theme it. So the theme for this one, which was on October, I think 28th, was horror.
Oh, fun.
Which is a subject also very near and dear to my heart. So I was asked to give the keynote. So that was really exciting. I've never given a keynote for anything before. And also delivered a talk on something I am obsessed with, which you will probably guess, folk horror.
Yes.
Yes. So I did so much research for that. I crammed so much into this talk. At this point, I'm like, this is almost like a thesis. I should probably organize this somehow, get the slides together and put it up on my Patreon for people. I don't know. It's people were really, really absorbed, really interested. We talked about, you know, kind of good folk horror, bad folk horror, how it's not just about setting, how there's this chain of events that has to happen into it, the chain of like values and morals, the outsider conflicting with the insider, the contrasts. It was just, yeah, people were great. We had a really good talk.
That's so wonderful.
Yeah, it was so nice. And then I came home and my cat judged me, which, okay, fair.
I mean, that's what cats do. Like, that's like, they have one job, and it's to make humans feel guilty.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He was looking at me very, very suspiciously as I was packing on the Thursday. He was like, you just got home on Sunday. I know you are not leaving again. And I was like, no, who would do that? Only a monster would turn around and leave her cat again.
Oh, he'll be fine, I promise.
Yeah, that's what I told him. And then I came back, and he was like, I hate you.
But he still cuddled with you and still sat on your lap and still ate the treats that you gave him.
There's some inappropriate cuddling going on. I can't breathe. Yeah, cats have no boundaries.
They absolutely do not. You are like an absolute master of folk horror. So I recently read your collection, No One Will Come Back for Us. And please don't judge me. I got it from the library.
Oh my God, why would I judge? I love when people get my books from the library. That's so exciting. It's like, oh my God, my book is in a library.
I live in a small town and I'm constantly nagging our local library. Hey, will you buy these, you know, these small press, like genre authors that you're not familiar with? And they often will. So I'm like the wonderful weirdo at the library. I loved all the stories, but my loved even more was like the folk horror ones. There were a couple that kind of take place in the same world where it's, leave the cream out for the fairies, but like also we're going to, you know, either the old gods or us will choose the annual sacrifice. And it's an honor for that person. And like, I'm horrified, but also it's like this really beautiful story of, you know, this is what creates this community. So I felt kind of weird, like finding beauty in this terrifying stuff.
Yeah, I think that's one of the really big, we mentioned this in the talk as well,
yeah.
Is one of the big contrasts with folk horror is that you do come in, and especially with visual, like the movies, it seems beautiful and safe and
yes.
Welcoming. And natural. There's often long shots of like sunlit fields. There's proof of like human connection to the land. There's beehives. There's orchards. There's
and I
forests,
love that.
There's fields. And it's not until later where you're like, oh, this is not the source of the horror. This is just the setting of the horror. So that's really what I was working on in Willing, which very much was also informed by my work, and studies and stuff in my second degree. I worked briefly at the Kinsella Research Ranch here in Alberta. I worked there for a summer as a summer student and learned a lot, and also learned a lot of stuff I did not want to learn.
What did you learn that you didn't want to learn?
That you should, many of the anatomical specificities of livestock and bison. Did not want to know any of that. Any of it, because I was studying soil. And also that if you hire somebody to build exclosures in your field, which is very important if you're studying soil and roots, make sure that you either supervise them or you look over the plans first, because otherwise they might build it without a door. So all summer, so an exclosure is just meant to keep out grazing animals. So ours had to be really high because we had elk at the ranch.
And they're very tall.
Super, super high if an elk gets a running start and they wanted to get into the exclosure. So, God, I think they were like 20 feet or something, 18 or 20 feet.
Wow.
Which should be, you know, high enough. And as far as I know, we never had any elk in there. But obviously that keeps out the cows as well. And it keeps out the bison. But anyways, it meant that every day or every other day, I had to put on my equipment, like strap it to me, which included a rhizotron, which is to monitor roots, climb up the chicken wire, or like 20 feet, and then climb down the other side, and then get my measurements, write everything down, and then climb back up and climb back over.
That's terrible.
That was a really long summer. That was a long summer.
I mean, you're able to laugh about it now.
I'm laughing about it now. Yeah.
But it was, climbing.
I would not be able to do that now either. I could only do it back then because I was like 22. So.
Oh my gosh, the things we can do when we're in our 20s.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, I hate to think about it now. But yeah, it was funny because I wrote that story and I wrote all the other stories and I hadn't really made like a study of folk horror or the structures or the tropes or elements of folk horror. I was just kind of doing it intuitively. And after that, I was like, maybe I am a folk horror. Because I look back at these stories and I'm like, they fit really neatly with the things that I've just spent like 3 weeks researching. But that was all a coincidence because I didn't know about that when I was writing those stories. Those were all years old. So,
but like intuitively, you were already there. You were already like intuitively, you were already in that, that storytelling structure.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, so it's nice when these things work out. Yeah.
Yeah.
If that story is, that story is willing. I love that story.
Yeah.
It's one of the few that I reread. And I think there is not one thing I would change about this. Like, there's not one edit I would make.
Yeah.
Not one comma I would take out.
I love that you mentioned kind of the setting, you know, and it's like for me, it's a very different experience to read a story versus like watching a short film or watching a movie. So like those, like the way you described it, those like golden fields and, you know, beautiful forests. It's like, oh, this is perfect. I feel safe here. This is wonderful. This is, you know, people are connected to the land and this is wonderful, but oh, there is a price. And like, I'm very drawn to stories like that where, you know, yes, you can have these lovely things, but none of this is free.
Yeah. None of this is free. There always is a price. And that's kind of the other, I guess, theme that kind of weaves itself through the stories too, is it's, we're used to, or we want to have a price that we have a choice of paying in life. But when gods get involved, the price is not optional.
No.
And we see what happens when you try to not pay.
Yeah.
Which is a really important part of the world building. And I guess an important part of horror too, which we also talked about at this conference, is a lot of horror involves the thing that frightens us most that we don't want to think about or give voice to, which is the loss of agency.
Oh, yeah.
The loss of autonomy. The inability of us as a person or as a character to not make choices in the story. And horror is something where...
where the choices, they become limited.
Often don't have a choice.
Yeah.
They become limited. Yeah. And the person is just dragged around or chased around by the plot events and seems to not be making decisions that drive the action forward. So sometimes people from other genres complain about that, but those of us in horror are like, no, that's the source of the fear. That is where the fear comes from, is that you are helpless in this situation. That bad things happen sometimes and you can't do anything about it. That's scary. You know, we did that on purpose.
And like, I can't watch horror movies. They're too scary for me. Like if it's rated PG, I will sometimes be okay, but sometimes not.
I can get up to PG-13, but anything scarier than Gremlins, and I just can't.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sorry.
I mean, the last horror movie I watched was, what was it? A Quiet Place. And I loved the concept, and I think it was PG or PG-13. And it was like right on the limit of what was too scary for me. But I can read scary things. And I think what What helps me get through the scary parts and the loss of agency in folk horror is the person or the community having this connection to the land, mm-hmm. having a connection to the forest or the trees or mm-hmm. the older gods that they don't understand. And mm-hmm. and I can't explain why, but that yeah. allows me to get
well, I feel
to get
that. Yeah, I feel it, that as well.
Allows yeah. me to get through the scary parts of it where, you know, I watch some, you know, a horror movie that that, you know, takes place in, you know, an urban apartment or something. And it's just too scary for me.
Yeah. No, same here. Folk horror to me, except for the movies, like, but folk horror to me in writing is like the ideal and manageable level of scary.
Perfect.
Like, yeah. Perfect level.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I guess kind of changing gears. I'm trying to cram like 6 hours of conversation into this short little podcast. I know you've been like super busy lately, but have you had any like favorite books or favorite short stories or TVs or just like wonderful stuff that you've seen or read lately that just gotten you been like, hey, that was really cool?
Let me think. I'm going to have to look up what the last name was. Okay, so the best book I've read recently was called Otherlands by Thomas Halliday, which is a really specific conceit. It's a nonfiction book, but it goes back in time to 12 specific ecosystems and describes each of them. And as a soil scientist, I thought this was like the coolest concept because I have also recently read The Rise and Reign of Mammals and The Rise and Reign of Dinosaurs by Steve Brusate, which kind of goes over the same ground. But it basically looks, those books basically look at the evolution of the wildlife, whereas Otherlands looks at the entire ecosystem as a whole and why it exists and how it exists and the weather patterns and bedrock and seismic movements and stuff that, you know, inform it. So I'm obsessed. I think I might read it again. I just finished it like 3 weeks ago. Best fiction I've read recently, definitely The Spear Cuts Through Water by Simon Jimenez. Just fantastic. Does things with narrative that I would not have thought were possible. I would like to imitate that. I don't think I can. I think the author was too talented. And Ithaca by Claire North.
Yes, I've heard about that.
Just fantastic. Has a really unexpected narrator. And also the voice is just so confident. And it's coming at the Odysseus story from such an unexpected angle. And things happening that are based on the original text, but of course can't appear in the original text. I just loved it. I heard there's a sequel. I have not bought the sequel yet, but I'm going to. I don't know if we have space in the podcast to mention this also, but I know in the questions you sent, you were asking about, you know, the bug thing.
Yes. Yeah. I've been following you online long enough that like you always have this adorable like drawing of a bug or a beetle. And you used to make all these like, yes, that picture right there, all these like cute bug jokes. Yeah. And it was just very, very fun and lighthearted. And I loved it. And what is the bug stuff all about?
Oh, yeah. It was so funny. You know where that came from was way back in the day. I was experimenting. So I was trying to teach myself how to paint with acrylics, A. But then B, I decided to start experimenting with acrylic inks. Acrylic inks are very expensive. So I kind of looked up how to make my own and I made a couple of colors, like bright primary colors. And then I decided to experiment with them. So I've been doing a couple of drawings and then I did a little beetle using dip pens on canvas. And I didn't really like how the texture turned out, but I liked how the colors turned out. So I think that was around the same time, honestly, that I joined Twitter. And so I was just using it as my profile picture because I had taken a picture of this little painting and I thought it was so cute. And then immediately people were like, are you a beetle? I'm like, you know what? Yes, I am. I'm just going to tell people that I'm a beetle. And people were like, wow, she's a beetle. So I just decided to run with it because it struck me as funny.
It was very endearing.
It's very dear. Like the reason my profile picture is a beetle is that I myself am a beetle. And then, you know, and I do like bugs. That's why I drew the beetle. But people also used to still sometimes send me like pictures of bugs to identify. And it's like, Sorry, I'm not a bug scientist. See, I'm not an entologist. I just like them. I may be able to help point you towards some resources, but I am a soil scientist.
I thought you were a bug scientist.
No, I just think they're cute.
A lot of them are very cute.
A lot of them are very cute. Yeah. Yeah.
Some of them are not, but some many of them are cute.
Less cute. I have ambivalent feelings towards things like giant centipedes.
Ugh.
I'm okay with house centipedes, although I think it's weird that since I moved into this house, I have not seen any house centipedes, even though it's an old house and I'm surprised that I haven't seen any. I don't know if the cat has anything to do with that. But
the cat's probably eating them all.
He probably is crunching them up. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got your adorable beetle painting avatar. Yeah. And
this literally is the original.
And and convinced half the internet that you are a bug scientist. And the other half of your social media feed is like me laughing my head off at the ridiculous things your floofy cat gets up to.
He's so floofy.
Oh my gosh. He's like 80% floof by volume.
He's mostly floof. Yeah. Yeah. This is my first cat, so I always apologize to people if I'm, over cat posting. I've never had a cat before. Felt sorry for this guy, because he was living in a shelter. I thought, now I have a home. Maybe you would like a home. And he mostly has just been the best little guy. He does crimes all day, every day. But they are mostly related to wanting to cuddle with Big Friend. And not wanting to stop cuddling with Big Friend, and also stealing things.
What's his favorite thing to steal?
Anything small and round. So I actually have one right here that I found the other day. So this is a lipstick. So he steals things like that. Pen lids, lip balms, lipsticks, anything about this size. And then he hides them in his bed or under his bed. So if I'm missing something about this size,
you just look in his bed for it.
That's like I frisk his stuff, and he watches me very anxiously. He's like,
"That is so funny."
I'm like, "It is not your stuff."
That is hilarious. That he's like, "Mom, why are you looking through my stuff?" He's a cat.
Why are you looking through my stuff? It's my stuff. I own the bed, and I own the pen that you stole, and I own you. And he's like.
And it's your lipstick that he stole.
And it's my lipstick, and you can't even open it. You don't have thumbs. So,
there is no such thing as too much cat posting. Social media is terrible for my mental health, but mm-hmm. looking at everybody's cat photos is very good for my mental health.
Me too. I love when people post their cat photos or their dog photos mm-hmm. or whatever, their lizard photos. Yeah, I don't care. Post your pets, because there's enough doom and gloom on the timeline that I attempt usually to make my timeline, if someone clicks over to it, like a little break. I'm mostly yelling about writing or teaching writing or books or cats.
Mm-hmm. I'm all about give me the cat pictures. Tell me about cool writing workshops that are coming up. I love it when, you know, any kind of pet photos or just like animal photos or aquarium photos, and I'm very happy.
Yeah. So. This is what I love about Blue Sky, actually, is for the first little while, my whole feed was pictures of like birds and marine creatures and people posting photos of their research animals. And it was just really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm having a good experience on Blue Sky. I like it.
Me too. I'm enjoying it a lot more. Yeah,
yes. Yeah. Yes. I hope it stays like this for as long as possible.
Me too.
Yes,
me too.
Yes. As we're getting to the end of our episode, tell me again, what's your website? We were talking about Blue Sky. So if people want to find you on Blue Sky, what's your handle?
Sure, yeah. Stuff that's coming up for me that maybe people would like to know about is I am teaching quite a bit, so keep an eye out on my website and my newsletter for upcoming classes. This will probably be out before, after everything's out, but I'll be teaching Revising Your Novel with Reach Your Apex and Nonlinear Fiction, which I'm really excited about. That'll be in November and December this year. And as mentioned, next year I have a novel coming out, The Siege of Burning Grass, with Solaris, and The Butcher of the Forest, as we've mostly been discussing with Tor.com, and the sequel to 2021's The Annual Migration of Clouds with ECW Press, which is called We Speak Through the Mountain, and also a, I was going to say novella, it's actually a mini collection with Psychopomp Press, and that's going to be called One Message Remains. So that'll be two new stories, The General's Turn, and then this new novella. So I'm pretty excited about
that. So exciting.
Yeah, and I'll be keeping people posted, hopefully on my website, which is premimohammed.com. And that's the same way you can find me on Blue Sky, because that's my handle, because they let you do that. And on Twitter, I'm there at premisaurus, and same on Instagram, where I am there a lot less because I keep forgetting Instagram exists.
Well, thank you so much for hanging out with me this afternoon and telling me about all of the just incredibly exciting things you've got going on, all the books coming out and all the workshops that you're doing. And I know you're just very busy, so thanks for finding some time for me.
Thank you for inviting me to chat. This was awesome.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.